Welcome, everybody. My name is Jacob Whitmer. I'm here with my friend and co-host, Aaron New.
Hey, what's going on?
Well, I gotta tell you.
You gotta tell me. It sounds like it's off to a dramatic start.
It's really not. I'm currently in the process of trying to plan out events in my life that won't happen for another 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing being, I'm going to try to get some publicity photos of me and the Serenade of Caffeine roster of people, like sometime in late May and early June. And I'm trying to find a photographer for that. I've storyboarded some ideas of how I want to go about doing that. I want to try to get photos that are like the Beatles' Mad Day Out session.
Yeah.
But I need to find a photographer who's got that kind of sensibility.
Was like setting up on a tripod and just self-timing it, or?
Well, the last thing, well, because this ideas I have storyboarded are a bit more artistic in composition and things.
Yeah, yeah, under that pain.
Well, let me explain this way. I have one idea for a picture of me in the SOC cast that I've had in my head now for years, and you'll understand this. So, you know Armstrong Hall on the West Virginia University campus?
Yes, yeah.
You know how it's got that giant staircase next to it that's got those different levels?
Yeah.
I've always thought that there should be, like, on the flat ends where each, like, new level begins on those stairs, there should be, like, a person standing on each of those. So you've got a nice, like, sort of pyramid thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that would be really cool. But I think that is a bit too... there needs to actually be a hand on to make sure that it's photographing correctly. I couldn't do it on a timer or anything.
Yeah, especially if you're doing something like that, I feel like if you threw it on a timer, then you might want to try new angles and stuff and being able to do that on the fly instead of having to, like, break the whole formation to get things
It really line, would just you know? Be, yeah, and the thing is that with my DSLR, it doesn't have, like, one of those viewfinder screens on it. I mean, it has it, but it doesn't have one that I can flip if I'm in front of the camera.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to make sure everything's in focus and in shot, I actually have to be behind it.
Yeah.
So it'll just be better for everyone if we actually have a photographer there.
Yeah.
I'm also considering investing in one of those, like, cranes for this microphone I use.
Uh huh.
Because the setup I have right now is that I record in the green room, which doesn't really have a table.
Yeah.
It's just I have a little stool, and I have my recording software and microphone all sitting on this stool. And I'm sitting on, like, a futon. And the distance between me and the mic is not really where it should be. I've never been able to really get it in a position that's correct where I'm sitting comfortable and the mic is also picking me up really well.
I feel like you've been in that room long enough, too. You might benefit from, like, get like a nice desk and a nice setup and stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just one of those things, like, if I could just get one of those cranes to, like, go from the desk to or the stool I have towards my mouth, I think it would make life much easier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like what we had in U92, those sort of like things. Now that's what I'm working with now.
I'm going to ask you
about what you're up to, but I'm going to issue you a challenge.
Yeah.
I want you to tell me how your week has been without mentioning the weather.
I was going to make a joke about that. I was going to go straight into not
mentioning
the weather.
Don't go into the weather. I'm going to challenge you. Tell me something that isn't about how the weather is in Washington.
Well, nothing exciting during the week. It's just kind of been, you know, it's just been another week. But the cool thing is, let's see, today's Friday. Yeah, so Friday. Tomorrow, I'll be going up to the city. I got a friend of mine coming in from, a friend of mine from Morgantown, actually. I don't know if he is from Morgantown, but, you know, we went to school. We hung out a good bit freshman year. And then kept in contact, you know, off and on for the past few years. But he's got a job interview out here, and he's coming down to Seattle to hang out for a bit and go up and hang around, check out some of the tourist spots, since I don't think he's been here before. And I'm going to spend the day doing that. So that's kind of the big news for me for the week. And then
that's nice.
I think besides that, it's just kind of been relaxing, cleaning up the house and doing the usual stuff. Yeah. But it's super cool. Besides my girlfriend's family, it's the first time somebody else has come out here to, like, hang out. Of course, she's got other things going on, but, you know, it's cool. It's always cool to see people, especially when you're 3,000 miles away from them usually. So,
of course.
Yeah. Yeah. Besides that, it's been a pretty chill week. Nothing exciting happening.
Very nice.
Yeah.
So, Aaron, I don't want to shock you.
What's that? Oh, no.
But I have some surprising news for you.
Okay. Hit me. I'm excited now.
Did you know that the 60s were 50 years ago?
Okay, so I had a similar thought today because I was on the phone with Zane for like 3 hours this morning, just trying to kill time.
Yes.
And we mentioned something about like, we're talking like the music scene and stuff and how it's not, like I can't really seem to find like the pulse of any sort of music scene around here. And I brought up like, you know, people coming out here are thinking like this scene should be big because it's got grunge. But then I'm like, well, grunge was like 30 years ago. And I stopped to think that, you know, 1990 was 29 years ago.
Yeah.
So, and I started thinking like, well, like all these events that, you know, to me seem like they happened so recently are just like quickly starting to become farther and farther in the past.
We're getting old, and we're getting old quickly.
I know, but like, I mean, the fact it was that long ago. Well, like 60 years ago?
What?
Would you say 50 or 60 years
ago? I said 50.
50.
60 years ago would be the 1950s, but the 60s were 50 years ago, and 69 in particular was 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And music was pretty significant in the culture of the 60s, particularly in 1969. This little concert that went on for 3 days. I don't know if you've heard of this. It was it's called Woodstock?
Maybe. I don't know. It sounds like it's, just something that...
I know. It's a bit underground. It's one of those things that's got one of those like little... a niche audience of people who've heard about it.
Oh, man.
But, so, apparently it was a big deal when it happened. I mean,
I guess so. I mean,
I guess it was important in American history or something like that. And to celebrate its 50th anniversary, Michael Lang, who is one of four organizers of the festival, has decided that he and some other people are going to stage a 3-day 50th anniversary festival in Watkins Glen, New York.
Yeah.
Now, this intrigues me, mainly because Woodstock in history has gone down as a chaotic success. And I put emphasis on chaotic because in many senses, it was a mess. And it actually, for all the artists who played there, they weren't that impressed. It became a mythical, you know, figure of history after the movie came out the following year.
Yeah.
A 3-hour-long documentary by Michael Wadley, which was edited by Martin Scorsese, if you could believe that. And like, in that sense, I mean, Woodstock became this mythical thing because of the movie, but it was not really, like, one of the best things that ever happened. And now...
It's been such... not to detract too much here, but, like, it was such a... sensational thing, at least it seems sensational in like pop culture, but like you look at it and you think like it was like just an absolute like literal mud fest.
It was
people
a literal
dying
mud
from drug overdoses. I mean, just one like logistically
died.
Terrible.
One person died of drug overdoses.
Oh, I thought it was multiple. Okay, never mind. No. But still, I
it
mean,
was there were two deaths. There was someone died of a heroin overdose, and then another person got run over by a tractor, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I remember that one.
So that it was like the two deaths. And,
but it seemed like, but looking back on like the, like just I guess the more intricate details of the festival, it was just it was an absolute mess.
Well, because the idea was that it was four people. It was this rock promoter Michael Lang. It was this like record executive, and then it was like these two entrepreneurs who like had all this money inherited from their family, and they were going to like go into business as a group of people to found a recording studio. And then the point of Woodstock was to promote or help inaugurate the recording studio that they were going to build in Woodstock, because Bob Dylan was there and the band were there, and they thought, well, it's near enough to New York and it's out in the country, so all the hip recording artists will want to go there to record, especially if they get a chance to be near Bob Dylan and the band. And then what transpired is that it was going to be a paid ticket festival. They didn't have enough time to actually set up the fence because they had to move shop to a farm. And then the fence was so ill-prepared that the crowd just, like, vaulted over it and smashed it to pieces. So then with... like 500,000 people there, they just went, okay, well, we can't police this anymore. Free festival. And then the rest of it was pretty much a lot of people taking a lot of acid and then wavy gravy going around talking people down off the ledge.
Mm-hmm.
And then a rainstorm in the middle of it, and then people sliding around in mud. And because they were all these Earth Children hippies, it was A-okay for them. Even though the promoters were running around panicking because they thought that they were going to electrocute like 500,000 people.
Well, that wasn't there like no food or water the entire time?
The food and the water and the supplies were being helicoptered in by like police. There were like helicopters going over the festival, and they were like parachuting in like food and water and supplies.
Well, yeah, because you couldn't drive in because the roads.
No, because the roads were all like
time.
Backed up for miles and miles and miles. Because that they were in. They weren't. The festival is called Woodstock. They weren't even in Woodstock. They were in Bethel,
which is like many miles away.
The sticks. I mean, it literally. It's like it is straight up like country place.
Mm-hmm.
And so they weren't, the town was overrun and ill-prepared, and just through sheer luck, it went off okay.
Yeah.
And the mythical status it got later on was because the movie then came out, and then you started hearing, oh, I was at Woodstock, like, from too many people to have actually been at Woodstock, because they saw the movie and, had their experience in the movie theater, where it was a bit more controlled.
Yeah.
And then because people were paying money to buy the ticket to see the movie, the like founders of the festival could at least recoup some slight amount of money back from the giant bankruptcy hit they took actually putting the festival on.
I wonder how, just like with the mess of the festival originally, and then all of the horror stories from all the like reboots, I guess, all the subsequent Woodstock festivals they
hosted. The main two revivals of Woodstock were then Woodstock 94, mm-hmm. which was competing with Lollapalooza in many ways. And that was all. That also became a mudfest. A different kind of mudfest, though.
There goes the owl.
There's the owl again.
I keep forgetting to put that clock away before we do this episode.
All these birds are just flying in all the time. We actually record in the forest, but No, I mean, like, Woodstock 94, that was, like, Woodstock trying to compete with Lollapalooza. The main mm-hmm. memory people have of that was Green Day showing up on stage and just getting mud thrown at them, which they then quickly threw straight back at the audience. And then Trent Reznor came out later in the evening with Nine Inch Nails and just slavered himself in the mud. And those are like the main two images people have of Woodstock. Mm-hmm. And then after, or at least Woodstock 94. And so there you had at least a kind of post-ironic comment on Woodstock. It went off okay, but mainly because they were courting a younger audience with the alt-rock rise. And because Lollapalooza has now kind of put the festival back into the spotlight again.
Mm-hmm.
And then to celebrate the 30th anniversary, they did Woodstock 99. Which ended in riots.
I thought that the Woodstock at 69, like for the longest time, I thought it was like this amazing thing. And then like, always little small stories of like the traffic and like, just like the absolute mess it was start coming through. I'm thinking like maybe this festival wasn't as bad as, or it was bad, was worse than it was made out to be.
The story I always heard from all the acts who played there was that the real big festival of the 60s was Monterey Pop in 67, because that was organized by the Mamas and the Papas and was on a fairground and was a more controlled atmosphere and had better sound system stuff.
But then look at Woodstock 99.
Woodstock 99.
What a story.
Who was it that was on the stage? Was it Rage Against...
That was
the
year of like... Yeah, I think it was like them and Limp Bizkit and I think Korn was there.
Korn was there and some older acts from the original. And I'm trying to remember whether it was Limp Bizkit or Rage Against the Machine. They were playing Hendrix's Fire as people started like actually looting and setting things on fire. Because, I mean, that was chaotic because the story goes is that they were on an airfield for one thing. In the middle of the summer, so it was blazing hot, and there was no shade or anything, and the water was, like, overpriced.
Mm-hmm.
And it led to people just, like, being like, fuck this, and just throwing a fit.
Yeah.
And the takeaway from it, like, I remember seeing this Behind the Music special that came out, like, a year later. And the big takeaway from it was that they, all four of the original founders, were like, yeah, Woodstock, I think, is over. I don't think we're doing that again. Until 2019, where things are more tense than they've ever been, ever. And now Michael Lang is going to be, hey, let's do it again.
But, you know, this time around, I think there's been enough. I think just the business of the festival has evolved so much that I think you could throw a 50th anniversary of Woodstock and make it successful. It's not going to be, it might be a mud fest like any other festival during like a rainstorm, but I think just the amount of trouble that Woodstock's been in with the past, I think they can avoid it this time.
Well, I'm fascinated by that because so far Woodstock is saying Michael Lang's going, we're going to do this, we're going to have some legacy artists and some hip-hop artists and some newer rock artists, and there's going to be like three stages, and yet no one's been announced yet.
Yeah.
But the thing that I have to ask about this is that you say that now things are at a point where the organizers know what they're doing. Here's my question. Even if the organizers know what they're doing, does the audience know what it's doing?
I think it depends on the audience. I mean, go ahead.
Because we are at this moment, some big news this week was the release of two competing documentaries on the Fyre Festival, which, to me, okay, so I am someone who pays almost, up until we started doing this show, I paid almost zero attention to actual pop culture. Definitely paid no attention to Instagram, and still don't. And so I think maybe when that all happened, I think I maybe looked at one poster for Fyre Festival because people were talking about it. Looked at the roster, said, I don't think anyone on this bill is anyone I like, and then ignored it. And now, like 2 years later, I'm watching these two documentaries and being like, it's like being a caveman being thawed out of the ice and going, what happened? What is this? But my takeaway from both of the documentaries, which we will talk about here now, is that what shocked me about both of them was it seemed to me something that was not really talked about in the documentary, but in either one, but I thought was kind of significant. With Fyre Festival, it almost seemed to me like the actual music portion of it was secondary to the image and to the fashion and the style of what it was meant to represent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you believe that that is a change in dynamic of the kind of audience that is going to music festivals? Because this is something that the Hulu one touched upon a bit. They had that guy from Billboard saying, if you look at the early festivals, it's music, 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 and then with the rise of Coachella, it kind of changes from being, oh, we're here to listen to the music, to, hey, we're here to just party and have a fun time.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think then that even if the organizers are got themselves under control and know what they're doing, is that really, are they catering, who's the audience they're catering to? Because I almost wonder if now the problem with a lot of music festivals is that the idea of the image and the fashion has kind of subsumed and overtaken the actual content of the music that people are going for.
My best guess is, at least with Woodstock, it's going to depend on the artist. So, if it's going to be a rock festival, I know there's like rumors of like Foo Fighters and stuff being one of the main headliners. If it's going to be that kind of rock festival, and I can compare it to like, what's a good example, like Cal Jam, which has kind of made a resurgence recently in some of those bigger rock festivals.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be the crazy wild audience that's there to party. It's going to be more catered towards, the fans of the music itself. I don't think it's going to be like a cultural, like a pop culture experience, Whereas some like Fyre Festival, which I never got a chance to watch the Hulu one because I don't have Hulu, but I watched the Netflix documentary and what I've known about Fyre Fest in the past. Is it's not so much, it's like a Coachella of sorts where it's focused more on the image and the culture and stuff like that. But in terms of audience, what Fyre was going for is not your typical music listener. They're going for influencers, which was kind of the buzzword that I got from the entire thing.
Which I just found bizarre. I mean,
yeah, they're trying to promote a brand, not the art,
Which just, then why have an art festival? That's what I didn't understand. I was like, okay, if it, let's say, okay, so they're promoting an app.
Yeah.
It's this guy, Billy McFarland, who's this, like, entrepreneur who somehow has money and no one knows how. And he is partnered up with Ja Rule, who I have never heard of in my entire life. Did you ever see... I'm going to make a reference to something that was in the Hulu documentary that you didn't see. Did you ever see that Dave Chappelle stand-up where he's talking about, like, when... He's, like, complaining about celebrities being brought out to talk about important things. And he's like, I remember on September 11th, MTV was like, and we got Ja Rule on the phone. And we're going to ask him in a minute what he thinks. And he's like, who gives a shit what Ja Rule thinks? Maybe I'm searching for answers to Ja Rule. Maybe I'm looking for questions that Ja Rule doesn't have the answers to. like, you'll have to pull up the little audio clip of it. Yeah. I'll send it to you. But it's okay. Like, I've never... What is Ja Rule's significance to the music industry? As speaking as someone who, like, only just recently, like, was getting into hip-hop and knows, like, some of the bigger names, like, what has he actually contributed to the course of hip-hop? What's his, like, lasting influence on the genre of hip-hop?
I don't think it's... Well... I don't know, but I do think the vibe I got from him is he's one of those artists, I guess you can consider him, but he kind of like had his boom as a musician and he ventured into taking that money he earned and reinvesting it and becoming more of a businessman. I think that's kind of his place now. Maybe he still does music. I have no idea, but he seems
I can understand that, but even like those rappers, I've heard at least one song of theirs. Like, okay, Chameleon Air had Ridin' Dirty, like, and 50 Cent had In the Club.
Yeah.
But, like, I literally have never heard of anything that Ja Rule has ever produced.
Maybe he's got big songs and we're just that oblivious.
I mean, I guess.
That's probably the case, because obviously this dude got money from somewhere.
Comment wherever you can comment and, like, link to me, like, examples of Ja Rule's talent, because I honestly have never heard a single thing he's ever done. So they're going, oh, man, Ja Rule's involved. You know it's important. I'm like, who is this man?
Yeah.
So... But what the thing that shocked me the most is that both the Netflix documentary and the Hulu documentary point out one specific person who mm-hmm. made the festival legitimate. One of all of them that was like, they said Fyre Festival is happening and immediately everyone lost their minds. And that was Kendall Jenner. And that perplexes me because Kendall Jenner is not a musician.
Yeah, what was it? Like
it's, are we in the age now where we are now letting the pop culture be defined by models? Because that was the main thing, is that both the Hulu documentary and Netflix documentary said everyone was sold in because look at all these models and all these Instagram people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I'm an advocate for online media, but I'm realizing now that I'm an advocate for certain kinds of online media. I think the distinction between a platform like YouTube and a platform like Instagram is that because YouTube is a video-based service, you actually have to have at least some slight amount of competency to do something. Like you're at least it's a medium where people are being won over by personality, but yeah. There's at least some craft to that personality too, mm-hmm. like. Yeah, there are people who, like, post Vine compilations or whatever on their cell phones. But, like, you know, you've got to edit it, at least. You have to edit it together and, like, actually write something out and come up with an idea of what you're doing. Like, the big, big stars, at least it seems to me on YouTube, that everyone latches to, are the personalities that actually, like, put effort into their work.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Instagram thing is like, yes, let's just follow these models. Look at us. Our contribution to the culture... is that we look beautiful, and we're coasting by on our good looks and our good looks alone. Anyone can look beautiful. Give me something to actually think about.
Something to connect with, yeah.
Give me something that actually like gives me an emotional connection other than looking in the mirror and going, ah, I'm an ugly bastard. Because I already know I'm an ugly bastard, so I don't need to be reminded of that.
Yeah.
You know? So I just, and it astounded me because it was one of those things where I was like, okay, we're going to hold a music festival. And then people, the music never even happened. The artists never even went to the island. And it was like all the investors and everyone getting screwed off for all the people talking. Like the big thing was they didn't have the tents. They didn't have the supplies. They didn't have all the things they promised and like the luxury lifestyle living. I'm like, if I'm going to a music festival, I don't give a shit about like the luxury lifestyle living. I care that, okay, I'll get like food and water. But like, look at, you know, if we're going to compare it to Woodstock, which Netflix did and Hulu both did. Look at the film of Woodstock. People are in sleeping bags, in the mud. They are there for one purpose and one purpose alone, and that is that they've got a bill of artists whose music they respect and admire and emotionally connect with. And they are there to listen to the music. What were the people at Fyre Festival there for? They didn't seem to be there for the music. They seemed to be there because they're like, well, we're being sold this image and this idea that we're going to be on a private island in the middle of the Bahamas and it's going to be paradise and we're going to be living the luxury life on our many hundreds to thousands of dollars. And then, yeah, that didn't happen, but it's like, well, what's the point of even being a music festival then? What are you selling? Are you actually there to listen to the music or are you just wanting to live on a deserted island for a weekend?
Yeah.
I'm not saying one thing is better or worse, but I don't get why Fyre Festival tried to pose itself as a music festival and is going down in legacy as one of the failed music festivals when, quite frankly, after watching both documentaries, I think music was the least important thing on everyone's mind in regards to that event. And
not because it failed, just in the nature of it being a thing in the first place. Like,
it's like, you're like, yeah, we're holding a music festival. I mean, and it never even happened. I mean, like, at least with other things, you can be like, okay, Altamont, the acts went on, the Hells Angels were the security, and things crumbled into oblivion because all the stoned hippies were, like, getting into fights with biker gangs. And the artists were kind of antagonizing it by playing dark music, you know. The Stones were not peace and love people. They were, you know, they sang songs about Satan and slavery. Like, so you had that. Same thing with Woodstock 99. I mean, Rage Against the Machine were a fuck you, anarchy, fight the system kind of band. And when they're soundtracking people lighting up the festival for overpriced water and setting the whole place ablaze. Like, there's a commentary there on the kind of music and the kind of audience that is being attracted to it. I can't find that with Fyre Festival because the music never even occurred. Mm-hmm. Blink 182 pulled out before the planes left, and then no one else even showed up. They had the stage all set up, and you see the lighting going off, but there's no one there. And everyone's freaking out about, look at this tent, look at this air mattress.
One of the craziest things that I learned just from watching the Netflix documentary was that I can't picture the amount of disconnect I have with the people that went to this festival. One of my favorite stories that I haven't seen it myself, but I kind of heard it through the wire from like friends and stuff, is that there was this kid who won, I guess he won like a radio raffle or something and got tickets for free to go to this festival. So he wasn't like the rich kid. He was just like a normal, you know, you and I kind of person. Got to this thing for free and apparently he said it was like this huge like treat to watch all these rich kids like have to like sleep in hurricane tents and like live up. Which, I mean, long story short, me looking at these like tents and stuff they were sleeping in, I'm looking at like all these amenities and stuff that they were promised, and then like seeing the reality, I'm thinking like, this isn't that bad. Like, I'm an air mattress in a tent, and I guess like the kids that went to this festival are just like, I don't know where the hell their money's coming from. It's just like their reality is so much different than mine. I don't understand it. I don't understand where they're coming from.
I mean, the Hulu documentary painted it on the fact that they were millennials. Like, that it was fascinating. Here's the difference, because you haven't seen the Hulu documentary. Here's the difference between the Netflix documentary and the Hulu documentary. The Netflix documentary was directed by Chris Smith, who directed that actor celebratory, self-congratulatory hand job that was Jim and Andy, and was funded by the media company Fuck Jerry, who were promoting the festival.
Yeah.
So they funded that.
Okay. The amount of...
The other one, for Hulu, actually had... They paid money to get an interview with Billy. And beyond him, a lot of the people who were interviewed were reporters and some influencers and and a former member of Fuck Jerry who had left after the debacle.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a difference in who was telling the story. Now
that makes a lot of sense because the Netflix one was very heavy on. I noticed there's a lot of Jerry Media content in there, but the story it was telling was like, okay, there's this one dude running this festival, which makes absolutely no sense, and all this thing goes wrong. But they don't paint him. They talk about the bad things, but they just, like, briefly touch on, like, this dude is in jail for, like, $20+ million in fraud, and they're painting, like, they're trying to paint it as such a light photo, I got the vibe, you know? Like, the amount of shit this guy did and got away with before he was finally convicted, and they're just kind of, like, brushing it over.
It was, well, they're brushing their responsibility over. That's what I heard. The complaint that I heard from people was that Fuck Jerry were completely absolving themselves of any responsibility, even though they were completely complicit in advertising the festival,
uh-huh,
when they didn't have a lot of material to really sell to people. Like, mm-hmm, they weren't getting info on, they were deleting people's comments on social media. They were tasked with doing that. A lot of the things they were posting were from a photo shoot that had happened 5 months earlier, and they weren't really giving people info on where do I go for my plane, what's the lodging going to be like, what's the mm-hmm site look like. Like, they weren't sharing any of that info.
Yeah.
It was fascinating that there were more of the employees of FIRE and the workers of the festival interviewed in the Netflix documentary than in the Hulu documentary.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's worth seeing both just to get the complementary aspects of each.
Yeah, I think, yeah, but especially getting the personal stories. I thought that
But the
that
Hulu
was
one, yeah, the Hulu one was fascinating in that because it was interviewing a lot of journalists and a lot of outside voices, they made a very interesting comment, which I half agreed with and half didn't agree with, which they said, what Billy represents, Billy McFarland, who was the head of FIRE, like, what he represented was the millennial dream of the entrepreneur. You're raised on the internet, and you're making money through the internet with this service that is making the ideal dream come true through the net. And what people are identifying with these Instagram models and everything is their sense of worth and their sense of being and all these things. And I'm sitting there thinking, I don't identify with any of this, and I'm a millennial.
Yeah.
I like this. This doesn't contribute to me at all. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm not taking my social cues by what Kendall Jenner does or whoever these supermodels do. I like, nothing they do inspires me to do anything productive in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the people I know also don't feel this way.
Yeah. I can't think of one person I know that honestly looks up to that realm of I don't even know how to describe it. Influence, I guess. Nobody looks up to that sort of thing for inspiration.
I mean, it's a fascinating dichotomy. I mean, I think there actually is. I would say this after seeing both documentaries and actually as I'm talking to you now. I think there is actually something that people overlook and maybe aren't even aware of. And I'm just piecing this together now, so feel free to cut it if it goes nowhere.
Okay.
But would you say that actually, more so than the baby boomers, more so than Generation X, there is multiple subgenres of the millennial generation based off of their economic status?
I think that's part of it.
Because I would say that I've always been frustrated looking at, and this is either on Instagram, on YouTube, wherever, I am always frustrated by a stereotype which does exist of the beautiful millennial crowd who are constantly taking their selfies on their phones and posting these glamorous photos of themselves and are so obsessed with the culture of the rich and the famous. And oh, how beautiful it would be if we could be the beautiful people like them living in our mansions. And then the crowd of people that I've been around in my time in a lesser economically developed area in the world, surrounded by people who don't have tons of cash to float around on cell phones every year, and being much more like, we use the internet just to talk to our friends and watch silly videos.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what I'd use it for. I'm not looking to like, if my influences going into making videos were online personalities, they were influences in so much that I wanted the respect of them in my work. Not necessarily in me as a person, but in the fact that I was making good content and they appreciated it. But it inspired me to actually create something, not look as beautiful and glamorous as I can and shell out how much money for some designer brand of fashion, you know. And yet that seemed to be what Fire kind of personified. It personified the obsession with the fashion and the look and the style of what the modeling crowd of people who made their success off of looking beautiful do.
Yeah, well, it was targeted towards this small segment of millennials. I mean, it's the people that festival was targeted for and the people that went to that and, you know, invested in it. It's not you and I. It's not the general public. It's this, what to me seems like the small segment of people who have either come for money or they've come into money at a young age and just, I don't know. I don't want to generalize too much or get too specific in any way. But targeted towards that, and that seems to be the focus that the majority of the public has on millennials. Like, when you say millennials, people think that. People, and this is kind of falling back on your comment of the economic difference. You and I being millennials, I'd say we're millennials because the generation gap is what I'm getting at. The whole generation gap in the first place, between like Gen X, Gen Z, I think it's the new one after millennials.
I've heard it's post-millennial right now.
I don't know. Defining it is difficult, if at all possible. I mean, just with the advent of the internet, anything after that, it just becomes so diverse and things spread out and there's like subcultures and sub segments of different things. It's hard to pinpoint it exactly.
I just was stunned. I mean, it appeared to me Fyre Festival was an incompetent mess and there was money laundering to high heaven. And it's shocking how much of it was filmed and archived. I mean,
that was surprising. Boy almighty,
was there a lot of film and archive of these people doing criminal acts for posterity. And it's like, why were you filming this?
I know.
I'm amazed the Ja Rule has somehow been able to evade prosecution. There's literally a scene.
There's a scene in the Netflix documentary
where they've got footage of a like company meeting after Fyre Festival collapses. And Ja Rule is there, and they're saying, should we just apologize to people and say we're sorry that we did this? Because we've like totally committed fraud. And Ja Rule goes, no. We didn't commit fraud. We just false advertised.
Hearing him say that immediately, just like I'm like, okay, this guy in particular is extremely disconnected with reality.
I was just like, how?
Good God!
I was like, okay, and how are they not all in jail?
Could you imagine?
Are they not all in jail?
How could? Okay, you imagine you're like an app developer. You get a job working for this company. You're building this app. Your boss and the team of people he's working with, like, you end up getting fucked over because your boss is committing millions of dollars in, like, laundering and fraud. And that comes back on you, and, like, and they're, like, trying to say, like, hey, like, we're a family, you know, we're in this together. It's like, what the hell? Like, I came here to build an app, not get, like, wrapped up in your fraud.
Here's what it became. The Netflix documentary is a lot of people saying, hey, man, don't shoot the gun at me. And the Hulu documentary is, here's the people who you're supposed to be pointing the gun at. and mind you, the influencers are like, there were some of them. There's one scene. Okay, so it was fascinating to me that the influencers are not depicted lovely in the Hulu documentary.
No, not
there's
at all.
There's one scene.
Well, I mean, well, not the Netflix one really either.
Neither in the Netflix one, but in the Hulu one, there's literally a scene. So I guess they didn't talk about this in the Netflix one. There was one influencer who actually did end up in a pristine place. And she's got the like LA Faye accent of, oh, well, you know, I was like, oh, you know. And she's like, I actually got a villa, and I felt so sad for everyone else. And then the documentary literally cuts to her Instagram posts of her and her friends, like, dancing around to dubstep music in this luxury house in the Bahamas. Meanwhile, outside, all the massive crowd is, like, losing their fucking minds. And I was like, yeah, you were real fucking sorry, weren't you? You felt such sympathy while you're up, like, you know. Living the high life, like, oh, you, the one individual fortunate one who actually got what you were advertised. And it was, like, insane. It was just insane. So, I don't know. I think, to me, what Firefest represents in my mind is the eventual... What Firefest represents in my mind, honestly, is the gradual end, the ending point of the gradual transition of, over the past 15 years, where the music business has reverted back to its state and status that it was in the 1950s and 60s, which is to say that the artist is not really in total control of the product, and they are not really looking to create or define grand statements. The music business is now selling image and personality more so than it ever has been. And the festival scene now, of people who are creating new festivals and are more concerned about the image and the marketing and the branding and less so about the content and the art and the actual experience itself. That's what it represents to me,
mm-hmm.
is the kind of... The idea... The big difference between a Woodstock and a Fyre Festival is that the audience who went to Woodstock were a group of people who loved music and thought that music was going to be the answer to save the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that musicians were going to be the ones who, with their music and lyrics and poetry, were going to end the war, were going to bring about peace, were going to make the utopian dream come true. And they thought that that's what they were getting. And they went in there with that belief and with the spirit to try to make even the most chaotic situation work, because it was that love brotherhood angle. That's why Woodstock worked. That's why Monterey Pop worked. That's why Live Aid worked in the 80s, was this idea of we're all in this together because we love the music so much. I think the chaos of Fyre Festival is representative of the modern audience being, well, these beautiful people look so lovely, and we want to look lovely as well. That's what it represents to me.
Yeah. I think that's actually what it's supposed to be, too.
Yeah. So, I think...
Not ideal in my mind, but hey.
It's not ideal in my mind either, but it's where the scene is at. So, we're gonna have to move on here now. We've been listening to records. We've been trying to keep up with the modern trends as much as we just spent 45 minutes slamming the modern trends. So, Aaron, what have you been listening to recently in the music world?
I've been I finally got my Spotify subscription back, so I've been milking the Discover feature, because Apple Music just frankly doesn't have any of the good stuff I like. So, in terms of like discovery features, you know, so.
They don't have what I like in terms of social features, but that's my thing.
Multiple things. But I got turned on to... And how did I discover it? Oh, Instagram ad, actually. I was like going through my Instagram stories one day. And
we just said why this was a mistake, Aaron.
Hey, but it depends on who you follow, okay?
Okay.
I follow other photographers and stuff, so I get... My inspiration is based on their work, not them as...
You're part of the problem.
Yeah, where's my ticket to Fyre Festival, huh?
Firefest 2019!
I kept so excited, huh? So,
he literally said that in the Good Morning America interview. He said, well, this was experiment one. It failed, but we're looking forward to Firefest 2018. read the room, man. Read the fucking room.
But yeah, so I'm going through my Instagram stories, and this video, it's like a little video ad pops up, and it's like... it's like John Prine around the microphone with some other people, and it's like, oh, the new John Prine album, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, oh, cool. I'm glad to see he's still making music. And then I check it out, and I got turned on to it more recently, because it's been out for a while now. this podcast I listened to, and they're discussing like John Prine and his music, and this album apparently they said it's very focused on the fact he's getting older, and like he's kind of like looking at it from like a lighthearted perspective. So I decided to check out the record, and there are some really good songs on there. There's one in particular called I forget the name of it, but the whole thing is just like this lighthearted take on, you know, you're getting old, you know, like there's a line, it's like you probably pissed the bed, your hair's over your head, blah 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 blah. I don't know. It's a really fun take on getting old, I think. It's probably the best way to describe it.
I thought it was pleasant.
This guy is in his, what, late 70s, I think? I don't know. He's had throat cancer, had all this, like, he's been through a lot of stuff, and he's got this very very warm, welcoming take on, you know, getting old and coming to realization with his immortality. So that's what I've been into recently. The True Forgiveness is the name of it. I think it's yes. A pretty solid album.
I heard it. It was all right.
Yeah, he's 72. It's just good. It's he's good 72. Classic songwriting, you know?
Yes.
Nothing fancy, just a guy and his guitar and then the occasional instrument speckled in there.
I thought it was pleasant. So the record I listened to this week, I've been trying to listen to some of the newer stuff that I missed that came out last year that got good reviews. I started a couple weeks ago with Courtney Barnett's last record, Tell Me How You Really Feel. Courtney Barnett, for those of you who don't know, is an indie rock artist. She made a big splash in 2015 with her, quote, official, end quote, debut album, Sometimes I Sit and Think and Sometimes I Just Sit, which was my personal favorite album of that year. And quite frankly, one of my personal favorite rock albums of all time, I think.
Yeah.
I remember when that came out and I was playing it for friends and we were all like, this is it. This is like, breath of fresh air and rock music. Her new record is more of a mood piece kind of thing. There's a lot more monotony in the songs and I found that a bit of a disappointment. There's a couple of decent tracks. The song City Looks Pretty, I think, for the most part, is really good. I'm not a fan of its ending, but I think it's all right. I'm gonna give Courtney Barnett the benefit of the doubt on this one. It's not bad. I would give it like a solid 3 stars, but I'm gonna give it the benefit of the doubt and say, okay, it's the classic second album syndrome, which is that
sophomore
the artist.
Slump.
I mean, everyone is guilty of this. Even the Beatles are slightly guilty of this, where the artist has how many so years to develop the material for their first album. And then the second album, they have only just like a little bit of time. And so I'm gonna give Courtney Barnett the benefit of the doubt and say Sophomore Slump, every classic artist is guilty of it to some degree, and we'll see what happens with the third album. But I would say City Looks Pretty is a fine song. I'd say listen to that. I would also recommend the Sometimes I Sit and Think and Sometimes I Just Sit album. That's just like, I think 12 songs of just great classic rock and roll songwriting at its finest. So
awesome.
That's my recommendation.
I need to check that out. I listened to the last record was it Kurt Vile? Like the duo album?
I overlooked that one. That album, in every sense, to me, seemed like a holding pattern. So I like didn't pay any attention to it.
I think it's got some good singles on it. Well, the singles are good. The album as a whole is not bad, but yeah, so I'm excited to check out this new record. Well, a newer record from her. So, yeah.
Yes. Right.
Okay, is that our cue to wrap up?
I believe it's time for the Juke Joint to close its doors.
Okay.
I believe this was a very fine episode. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed talking. And you enjoyed listening.
Yeah. Thanks for sticking around thus far.
You'll have to re-edit that sentence to have it make sense.
No.
Because I said it in fragments and out of order.
We are not so flawless. We are all the bad things go into the final edit. God, I can't think today. I never can think. Anyways,
he's insane. Got no brain.
I try to fire back with some sort of like witty statement. My brain just shuts down. It's like nope. You're not going to be nice. You're not going to be witty today.
I just responded by quoting Cypress Hill.
The reference just completely went over my head. So,
anyways, insane in the membrane, insane in the brain.
I have
really?
No idea. I've listened to it once in my life.
Have you not heard
maybe?
That song?
Maybe forever ago, but I mean.
Oh, that song's a banger. You gotta put that on. That's my new recommendation. Listen to Cypress Hill, okay. Insane in the Brain, because that is an all-time classic of early 90s hip-hop, and The fact that you've let that one slide through the Clorox for so long, unacceptable. Good sir.
All right, well, let's roll out of here.
So
this is the Juke Joint. If
you're listening on Anchor FM, you can check out Aaron's Twitter and Instagram, and you can check out my Twitter and YouTube channels. If you are listening on Spotify, I'm certain you can find our accounts there. You can look at our lovely public playlists. I got a lot of fake Beatle albums up on mine, and Aaron's got a bunch of stuff as well. Check out his band, What's Missing. They're also on Spotify.
And yeah, don't forget whatever podcast service you're using to rate us, whatever you decide is fair. Hopefully 5 stars, that'd be rad.
Understand we're slowly but surely fixing the audio issues. So
yeah, we're back to Google. So hopefully, yeah, because nothing.
We're also recording our mics separately, which I think is going to actually give us better control over the fidelity.
Yeah, I guess we'll find out once we're done recording.
Hopefully, you have to tell me, Mr. Editor.
I only write the show. I don't edit it. I don't have time.
Anyways, yeah, leave us a comment on your podcast service of choice. Be sure to subscribe. And keep up to date with new episodes that come out every Tuesday or most Tuesday mornings. I think we've been every Tuesday so far, but sometimes we might miss a week just depending on if we're busy or not. But yeah, Tuesday mornings. That's when you want to check out the new episodes. Yeah. All right. I'm going to wrap it up. This is the end. I think this is the end, right?
And this is the end.
Bum, bum. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.